A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And on this week's New Statesman podcast,
we talk about MPs behaving badly. Should Jared O'Meara have been suspended and when?
We ask if Universal Credit could ever have worked.
And we ask whether or not Nick Clegg will make a triumphant return in Sheffield Hallam. It is to everyone's massive relief, I'm sure, Stephen, that I think we should talk about something other than Brexit this week, namely, how badly do MPs have to behave before they get suspended? Obviously, this is coming off the back of Jared O'Meara's suspension from the Labour Party. And I think one of the things that's really fascinating about this story is you have to take your hat off, and I slightly object to doing this, to the Guy Defaux website for the old-fashioned sting way they pursued this story, in the sense that they put out some things that were kind of borderline comments from a really long time ago, obviously hoping to cause a kind of elephant trap to kind of for people to plunder in and say that they defended him and actually he'd changed and he'd moved on, and then kind of hit people with more recent comments and some ones that were less defensible, and kind of managed to contribute to this kind of ongoing feeling that, you know, there was no idea where this story would end, which obviously is why it's ended in suspension. So at least the Labour Party can look at everything in the round and do a proper investigation and report. How bad do you think the comments were? Should we talk about what the comments were for a start? Because I think that's one of the things when you doing online abuse stories or you're doing unacceptable comments that people have made, actually it's quite often quite hard to find out what things people have actually been saying.
This is actually very interesting, and I'm afraid I am going to mention my must-read morning email now, right? The challenge I always have with that is that there are about 400 different work-related filters, right? There's the Guardian's filter, there's the Treasury's, there's Dexu's, there's the various six affiliated trade unions, all of whom will have different things and set things off. But you know for certain that if you use words like
cock.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually not even sure what our iTunes rating is, but let's see if
I'm
we can get
about
a,
the
a
male
rated
chicken.
R. But that does mean then on the first day I referred to him referring to someone as a dog of the female persuasion, because I knew that I could not get away with using that word and not immediately nerf the number of people who...
That's very New York Times. Do you remember when the New York Times reported on John Terry and they had to try and say, a man who was once had romantic affiliations with his mother and then a racial epithet?
Yeah. So, I mean, I agree with Clive Lewis than using the word a dog of a female persuasion in a joking sense to a man is still not an acceptable use of what is ultimately an incredibly gendered insult. However, there is obviously they're both things which I would prefer people not to do, but there is a big difference between one which is a kind of like,
get on your knees, bitch, which is a laddie banter to somebody who is also in on the joke. It's not a joke at their expense. And calling somebody you ugly bitch in a way that's intended to demean them, right?
Yeah, although the weird thing is actually Guido wasn't as clever as they looked in terms of releasing this. They had the, you know, I wouldn't touch you with a manky woman's cock, you ugly bitch, which I'm not sure if that is intentionally transphobic or just incoherent, but they actually had that in June, immediately at the point when everyone was running around going, is Theresa May dead? What's going on? Is Brexit going to be stopped? And people didn't really notice it. Those remarks are not, in my view, acceptable and are not, I think, reconcilable with being on the Women and Equality Select Committee. And obviously, you know, it's not my wheelhouse, but they are, in my view, not what I would want in a representative of a left-wing party. But because the people who have been weaponizing it don't really care about the issue, right? A lot of the people who've been angry about it care, but the actual media organization which has covered it, let alone the kind of synchronized tweet-a-thon from CCHQ.
Yeah, if Guido Fawkes really cared about sexism, then I would advise them to have a little look at their comment section, right? Which is just full of people saying like, that all the long day.
Give a monkeys about it. And the interesting thing about the fact that they didn't give a monkeys about it is it kind of meant you had this weirdness of there was a whole sort of 8-hour period when it looked as if everyone was just going to have a conversation about whether or not some homophobic things that he'd said 12 years ago, which were deeply unacceptable, but obviously 12 years is a period in which, yeah, I mean, it's a period in which Tony Benn went from the right of the Labour Party to the left of the Labour Party. It's a period in which, you know, Harold Mosley went from...
Oswald Mosley went from, I'm going to get this right, Conservative Party to Labour Party to the New Party to the British Union of Fascists.
Yeah, right, that seems like, there's a great deal of political travelling one can do in a 12-year period. But because, basically, the CCHQ noise machine didn't really care about any of the actual problem, it kind of took a bunch of women... And actually, a lot of people in LGBT Labour were incredibly vocal about this, saying, well, you know, the comments 12 years ago are bad, but he may have changed. However, we're quite concerned about these allegations about things he said to women 3 months ago that don't seem to have been addressed. But yeah, I think the thing I've really struggled with, and I think the difficulty with all this kind of story, is because you can't really use the language in a lot of contexts. And one of the things I like about the New Statesman style guide is we don't star out a bunch of words I'm about to very coyly allude to.
Well, that's
one
of the things that Mary Beard said when she was interviewed for the New York Times about online abuse. She said, yeah, because no newspaper will print it, no broadcaster will say it, it looked as if a lot of people had basically been rude about my hair. And that's one of the things, is unfortunately the way that the prettiness of the way that it's covered, you know, unfortunately inevitably makes it look like people are moaning about nothing, just a little bit. And actually you have to read the comments. You know, certainly like one of the things that was really interesting about the Harvey Weinstein allegations was it was only by reading the allegations and this thud, thud, thud of repetition of the same incident happening that you really got the kind of full measure of how grim and disgusting it was. And if you don't expose yourself to what's actually been said, it's very hard to recreate that kind of atmosphere. I remember Laura Bates of Everyday Sexism, and I once did a programme with her. We were talking about online abuse and she said, well, actually the thing is that rape threats are the easiest thing to talk about in some ways, because you say someone threatened to rape me and people go, oh, that's bad, right? And actually it's one of the few things that you can talk about at 9 a.m. on the Today programme, whereas this kind of fusillade of grim language and all these weird violent imagery that people send you, you know, you can't ever recreate that atmosphere for the person at home. So yeah, I think they were right to suspend him. I think it was difficult that one of the things that upsets me about this stuff, and you've talked about this before with your analysis of the woke right, is when it just becomes a partisan kind of dividing line. And actually, I don't like it when people on the right sort of instantly, you know, they want feminists to condemn this stuff. But when they don't think it's that bad themselves, that's my issue. Also, can we talk about the fact that Guido Fawkes has now become a really obvious repository of CCHQ lines, right? They've got a great line into CCHQ, clearly. This is my belief anyway.
This is something that lots of Labour MPs believe. And one of the reasons why they think that the new operation in CCHQ is sharper is they basically go under Cameron, Guido Fawkes had lots of great lines, that dried up under May, now it's back.
It's also very funny when you remember one of the big Guido stories is taking down Damian McBride for this idea of having a kind of leaks and smears website, which they'd use to do this kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, Guido, of course, fiercely contests this and say that actually CCHQ leads where they follow.
No.
Unless that's the biggest Freudian slip
in history.
But anyway, that's the kind of substantial. Let's do the criminology.
Okay, so the thing that was first of all that was interesting to me was, yeah, Owen Jones wrote a column saying that he's been on a journey, which again, I think he fell into the elephant trap because it turned out that the journey had essentially ended in the same place that he started with, i.e. still using unacceptable language a couple of months ago. And then Paul Mason did an amazing tweet which said that this showed the case for mandatory reselection because this wouldn't have happened if a local candidate had been selected. And my issue with that was Jared O'Mara supported Corbyn in both leadership elections. He was the Momentum-backed candidate. The leader's office were very happy with him. I don't think there's any evidence that actually there was a big groundswell in the CLP for somebody different. So my issue is more that I think probably the timing of the snap election just meant that there wasn't time to properly vet people generally.
Well, I think yes and no. Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be the Labour Party if there wasn't a factional dispute about everything, right? But so the following things are true, right? The NEC, in the brief period when Corbyn had a majority on on it immediately after he had seen off the attempt to get rid of him in 2016, voted through a swathe of powers to prepare for a snap election, partly because they thought Theresa May won't call one, partly because John Trickett, then newly appointed as election coordinator, wanted to show some kind of, you know, like,
we're ready,
look,
come on,
we're
bring
ready.
It on.
We're,
yeah.
we're doing something. Because they obviously didn't want to look like they were rattled by the Conservatives. So in some ways, this is one of the situations where the leader's office can't really go, oh gosh, we were had. But also, he was the preferred choice of the leader's office. There's an important but, there's two important buts actually at the end of this. The first is that the NEC is in theory meant to use its long-listing power to vet candidates who do stuff like this, so that when the local party decides, it knows that it has a clean pool of candidates. Of course, in reality, whoever is in the ascendant at the party centre uses that to get candidates they don't like off the long list. It has never really effectively been used to vet candidates. And because only a handful of people in the party believed that they would gain seats, to be honest, most of those seat selections were not taken very seriously. You had a couple of places, so Karen Lee, who actually it's turned out was elected, the MP for Lincoln. She's highly rated by a lot of trade union political officers. She's come up from being, I want to say a nurse, but she may have been a midwife. But the idea was that she would dip her toes in running this time and she wouldn't actually win. Obviously, she
Yeah,
she
I think
won.
It's really noticeable when you're talking about what the Labour's leader's office and the union's expected election result to be, the fact that there wasn't a great clamour to parachute somebody into Slough, for example, and they ended up running a local candidate.
Because the idea wasn't Slough was probably not going to be held.
And that was a Labour-held seat with what in other words looked a nice little majority, certainly not a wafer-thin margin.
Yeah, and so it's true that there was inadequate vetting. However, then this is, I think, the more important part, particularly because of the kind of general sort of Weinstein mode of openness and people being exposed to the things they've done. In terms of the Labour selections I have covered and things I have heard about from right to left, including stuff where, you know, you could stand it up but only by naming the victims who don't want to be named, the idea that factions of left and right haven't gone, OK, he's a bit bad to women, but he's our guy, and then in an open selection that wouldn't still have happened, is for the birds. However, what is also for the birds is, you know, there were a lot of kind of excitable commentators and Stephen Daisley was one, effectively going, oh, well, this is kind of unique to the Corbynite left. And you can kind of feel at the moment the waves of openness from Weinstein kind of beating at Westminster's door. It obviously most strikingly happening with...
No, look, I mean, I've heard big rumours about a senior Tory minister who is apparently a complete bully to women in their office. Yeah. The Lib Dems had the Lord Renards scandal in which several accusers came forward and there was a lot of publicity about them. Essentially nothing really happened. So unfortunately, nice though it would be to say this, there is no partisan spin on sexism and sexual harassment and misogynistic attitudes in politics.
I think the interesting question is whether or not what starts with O'Mara ends with O'Mara.
Hi, I'm Anna.
And I'm Caroline.
And together we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously.
Every Tuesday, we look at three bits of pop culture, one brand new, one slightly less new, and one from way back, and analyse them in lots of depth for our listeners.
It could be anything. Film, TV, music, games, books, web series. We believe everything is worth taking seriously.
If you would like to know why the Emoji Movie was so bad and what's gone wrong with the Bake Off since it moved to Channel 4, but you're also interested in 1940s movies and high-concept electronic music, this is the podcast for you.
To subscribe, search SRSLY in iTunes or any other podcast app, or visit seriouslypod.com for more details.
Universal Credit continues its troubled, not quite passage through the House of ministers being called back, the opposition going, this is bad, we want to have a vote on it, them going, well, you can't fire us, we quit, and then abstaining on the vote and still rolling it out. The government is taking a lot of false comfort from the fact that the majority of people who are on universal credit are moving into work and are satisfied by it, but the majority of the caseload are simple cases, so that's what you would expect.
Well, they rolled it out, first of all, to people who are only claiming job seekers allowance, and essentially single men in the pilot areas, which I think is a sensible thing to do if you're going to test a system, you know, to kind of ease yourself in gently, but it doesn't leave you with a very good sample group. And now the big thing about the accelerated rollout that started in October is the idea you're putting more complex cases on and people with more kind of chaotic living situations particularly. The question that we got asked, which I think is a really interesting one, is could it ever have worked? I'm sure I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but Philip Collins once wrote a great column about universal credit, comparing it to the Sagrada Familia, which is Gaudi's church in Barcelona, which has been 10 years off being finished since basically Gaudi fell under a tram. And I think that something similar feels very relevant to universal credit because it is a phenomenally complicated system. And what it's doing is moving all the complication and the patchwork of benefits, all that complexity from the individual claimant to a computer system. And if there are more terrifying words in the English language than government IT project, then I do not know what they are. Everyone across the political spectrum agrees that having a single benefit is a brilliant idea in theory. My problem with it is I think it came out of an evangelical mission of Ian Duncan Smith. So he has this narrative of talking about going to Easter House in Glasgow, meeting people, realising how terrible it was that work didn't pay and wanting to kind of do something about that. The trouble is he'd been saying all of those things in, I think, Centre for Policy Studies think tank reports earlier to that, right? The scales did not fall from his eyes. They confirmed a thesis that he already had at best. And I think the way that it's designed is also, frankly, that kind of, I say it's Christian, but it's a very particular kind of Tory Christianity about the idea that what, you know, the state should be there to reinforce marriage, particularly in the nuclear family. And my issue with that is that often means keeping together dysfunctional nuclear families. And I think that's something you see in the design of universal credit, with this idea of it going to the household and, you know, having to ask if you want a split payment. I think that's the trouble. It makes it very difficult if you are the partner of an abusive, financially controlling person in order to actually get your financial independence back. And we know that's a big thing. You know, look at something like the Mick Philpott case. You know, that is somebody who absolutely kept their partners pregnant as a way to control them and rationed their money as a way to control them. That's something you see a lot in domestic abuse situations. So I think in the pursuit of trying to make this kind of A, making work pay, and B, family-friendly benefit system. And so the old family allowance, for example, which was paid to the lead carer, which is usually the mother, then I think that was a problem from the start.
I think there are a couple of problems. I would agree with all of that. The second, of course, was that you cannot really change a benefit system while spending less money on it, particularly because in the early stage, you have to be able to run your pilot scheme and go, oh, this hasn't worked, we need to change this.
Well, that's what we're finding out with Brexit, really, right? Yeah. Even if you believe in the long term, Brexit will bring back money. Actually, the implementation phase of it is definitely going to be incredibly costly. Even the most, you know, ardent Brexiteer admits that now.
But I do also think primarily, I mean, that's, yeah, before you get into things like paying it in arrears, paying it monthly.
Well, actually, Ian Martin, who I kind of credit as the most sane Brexiteer on Twitter, not a particularly hotly contested award, admittedly, made a good point on the Sunday Politics this weekend about people who are, for example, Uber drivers getting paid in micropayments via the app, right? And actually, one of the things that is now a feature of low-paid, insecure work in Britain is not getting paid monthly, but even getting paid like hourly, or like per job, and the way that that works. And the idea that you can switch from the kind of just-in-time mode of that to suddenly waiting 6 weeks as it currently is, even if there is a U-turn, you expect it'll probably be 4 weeks. That's a big ask for people now.
Yeah, I think it's things, but even kind of fairly stable, low-paying work, it sometimes pays on weekly and fortnightly. And the other problem with lumping housing benefit into it is if you have been made unemployed and let's say hypothetically you've had to go on your overdraft, I mean, which is not hard to imagine, right? And then your housing benefit like gets lots of overdraft charges, right? And then suddenly you're £20, £30 short. Well, that £20, £30 very rapidly adds up. The good thing about universal credit is it's a very useful thought experiment to start going, well, what would our benefit system ideally do? However, the point of a thought experiment is it leads to a policy. You don't actually try and implement the thought experiment.
The housing benefit thing, I think, is a really fascinating example of, you know, this sort of Tory idea of wouldn't it be great if we instilled responsibility into people by making them manage and budget their own finances? And actually previously being paid directly to the landlord was because there was an acknowledgement that that was a way to make more landlords want to take on housing benefit claimants, right? So you didn't end up with a situation where people would say, and like, you know, they used to no DSS. And I think that's a problem because, you know, actually some of the people who are happy on universal credit, I spoke to a woman who had previously run a business of her own. She got breast cancer. She had to stop working. She actually, now that she's on full-time Universal credit is fine because she's the kind of person who is absolutely used to budgeting and used to that. What completely screwed her was the six-week wait, and then actually a payment was delayed. She had to get a piece of paperwork relating to she was divorcing her husband and they owned a house together about whether or not she was getting rental income for that. So that was the bit that really naffed her. But at least when that's all sorted out, she is the kind of person who is used to budgeting and has a strong support, was able to borrow from family and friends. The problem with the benefit system is it has to in some way be designed to deal with the hardest possible case. And this is something you see in other areas of public policy as well. One of the really big problems, I've just been editing a piece about the freeze on domestic violence refuges. And there is a big problem with people, women particularly, who have no recourse to public funds. So they might be on certain immigration status, for example, but they're currently going home every night and being beaten up. And actually, where in the system do you have an ability to deal with that when those are kind of people who are living in a kind of complete grey zone? That's really, really difficult. Who is expected to pick up that slack? It's the same thing you see in prison policy, where prisons end up being the kind of sluicing gate for people who have failed all the way through a lot of other systems. For example, particularly care leavers. There's a disproportionately high number of care leavers in prison. People who have been the hardest possible case, where in the system ultimately ends up being responsible for them. And it's not really clear with universal credit that there is that safety net at the bottom.
And making all of this worse for the kind of final terrible cherry on top isn't the Treasury, because for ages they didn't think it would happen. Their way of making free savings in budgets under Osborne would go, and a bunch of cuts will be grandfathered into universal credit.
They did with tax credits, right? They said, obviously we can't implement this now because it's really unpopular, but lo, under the day when universal credit dawns upon us, then shall we cut everything in sight?
For a long time was the Treasury view that universal credit was an unworkable disaster, that sooner or later someone would have to say to the DWP, well, you've had your fun, Ian, but now it's over. But now you have a situation where, for a variety of reasons, the Secretary of State has changed lots of times. The Conservative grasp on the policy is not what it ought to be. And now
there is a touching belief, the fact that David Gawk, because he's good on going on telly to defend things that Osborne used to do, is also going to be able to defend this policy, right?
I think then there has been a massive overestimation of the value of the easiest cases being happy on universal credit, and a massive underestimation of the fact that there are some things that you can't uncork the gawk for.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
And in the wake of Jared O'Mara losing the whip, a lot of people have asked us, were he to resign, would this mean that Nick Clegg might come back into the House of Commons?
Ride back on his white charger speaking five languages. I'm doing an event with Nick Clegg next month, and I'm really tempted to ask him to speak five languages. Is that self-indulgent, or is that quite hot? I think that's quite hot.
I mean, it could be both.
Anyway, the problem is with this is that Nick Clegg doesn't want to come back, right?
Nick Clegg has said he won't run. And this actually is an interesting example of the Lib Dems' wider problem, right? That their result was actually a lot worse than it looks. There are only 38 seats in which they are second, and only 8 of those where they are under 10,000 votes behind the second place party. And their worst news isn't, because obviously they have to work really hard to get those second places, a lot of those MPs or candidates are not standing again. Nick Clegg is not standing again. Martin Horwood in Cheltenham is not standing again. Another candidate who, embarrassingly, I have forgotten, and I can't get Wi-Fi down in the podcast catacomb, has announced relatively recently that they're not standing again. And it's not clear if Greg Mulholland in Leeds North West, which they also lost to Labour, will stand again. So the prospect for Lib Dem gains at the next election at a parliamentary level is quite grim.
And that's also tied into another interesting facet of the 27 election result, right, which is about the fact that obviously the big divide being both Tory Remainers going to Labour and not going to the Lib Dems, and also the socially liberal deciding not to go with the Lib Dems because of how toxic they found Tim Farron's views about homosexuality being a sin and abortion. And I think that is another big problem. I mean, Vince Cable has got a lot of fine qualities, but an ostentatious social liberalism and an ease with modern Britain is not necessarily one you associate with him.
Julian Huppert.
Julian Harvard of Cambridge, yeah.
Our excellent recording artist, John Elledge, has just flashed a sign with Julian Harvard saying he's not standing.
I knew he wasn't going to be able to make it through the Lib Dem part of the podcast because, of course, John has joined the Lib Dems after a Twitter poll.
No, I bloody well haven't.
He should, though. Why don't you F off and join the Lib Dems, John? Anyway...
I read about housing and trains and Doctor Who. I have no idea why anyone would think I was a Lib Dem.
You're right. This does point to the wider problem that the Lib Dems have, which is that they're the answer to a question that actually mysteriously nobody is asking. I mean, they ought to be the answer to the question that everybody's asking, and yet they don't seem to be. Labour has picked up all of those gains, and we've ended up in this sort of weird two-party system again.
Well, I think the problem isn't diehard Remainers can count, right? They might feel more comfortable with the Lib Dems, but they also know that actually the sentence, vote Lib Dem to stop Brexit, is innately a bit silly.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush. We were recorded by secret Lib Dem John Elledge and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Understore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. If you want to, why not sign up to Stephen's morning email or listen to the City Metric podcast, Skylines.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.